Good afternoon, everyone. This is like a big family reunion here, wasn't it? Karen only said it'd be like five or six people that were interested. I'm shocked. I know when I was, I grew up in a big family, and when there were 8 or 10 kids, depending on the day, and the thing was, when one kid got one thing, the other kids got it. And so my mother was always, you know, hounded into me the importance of you know, being clean and not swimming so you wouldn't get polio. But our generations change and people change, you know, and I know I tell my wife often about coming from a big family, the only time that I had to sleep by myself was after I got married. Any event, I think the situation has changed, the time has changed, and different generations have changed. And of course, we talked about how the philosophies have changed about immunizations as well, and why you can have all different reasons why you wouldn't. I think one analogy I heard someone say, you know, the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse is the one that gets the cheese. So I think. That a lot of times exemptions have become, we've become kind of a nation of the mouse, you know, mouse waiting for somebody else to take the risk. So, in any event, just tell you a little bit about the Arkansas experience. But first, there's only two states, West Virginia and Mississippi, that don't currently allow for religious exemption. One thing, if you come away today with one concept is that you do not, it's not constitutionally required that you have a religious exemption in your state. It's not required, and not required by the Constitution or otherwise. And it really, the law with respect to immunizations all derives from, as Preta mentioned, this Jacobson decision, a landmark case involving Reverend Jacobson. And of course, most of you, I'm sure, have heard the story. You know how much he was fined for refusing to get an immunization. You know, it was $5. That's, and they agreed, you know, to waive even the fine, but he decided to pursue it anyway. I think he was a Lutheran minister, so all of you Lutherans out there may be able to relate to. I told them in the religious exemption argument that I came from no organized religion. I was a Baptist at the time. So the state's authority as set out in Jacobson derives from the 10th Amendment, but there's also a legal concept in addition to the 10th Amendment I want you to be aware of, and that's called parens patriae, which is the state basically has a duty and obligation to protect those people who can't protect themselves, which includes children. And under Jacobson, it said the police power authorized the state to compel vaccination for the public good, and the state power is constitutional and acceptable if it's exercised reasonably. Jacobson established, and we today, and I've represented public through the Attorney General's office or the state as a general counsel for the health department many years, there are four basic concepts that Jacobson established that we still use today in arguing any public health rule or regulation as a floor to meeting constitutional protection. First, you have to show that the rule or regulation demonstrates it protects a demonstrable health threat. Secondly, it has to be reasonable means. In other words, the intervention that you are proposing has to be reasonable to achieve that objective. You can't isolate everyone. For example, if quarantine would be a reasonable and proportional response to a public health crisis or problem. And then finally, Jacobson established the idea of harm avoidance. Before this time, there was really no requirement that someone could be exempted if the vaccine was contraindicated. And so you could basically force someone to take the vaccine even though it might kill them. And Jacobson established a legal concept that as part of that vaccination, it must not be medically contraindicated. Jacobson had, in fact, alleged that he and his son both had had a reaction to a vaccine previously, and it caused severe problems. And the court, in upholding the vaccination laws in Massachusetts, and specifically in Boston in this case, said that basically they didn't believe him. So he was a Lutheran minister, he didn't believe him. He was. In any event, in Arkansas, we progressed, in the 60s, there was a move in the country, primarily in Alaska and California, although all over the country, in which they were enforcing child immunization school vaccine laws. We were part of that move as well. In 64, there was a challenge as a result of the stepped up enforcement in the Coud versus State case. And there, our Supreme Court ruled that children must be properly immunized before entering schools despite their religious objections of their parents. So we then, next year, and 64 was an important case because that led to a change in our law in 1967. But in 65, there was also, it's important that these things track throughout several states how that immunization laws are challenged. In this case, in the mid-60s, there was a challenge saying that you had to show that there was a necessity or that there was a need. There was a, in other words, that there had to be smallpox in the community. There had to be some real threat in the community. In this case, they argued there had to be a clear and present danger in the community in order to require the smallpox vaccine. Our court rejected that, and most courts have rejected that theory as well, and ours did in 65. After the 64 case, in the Coud decision about religious, basically putting aside the argument of a requirement that constitutionally mandated religious exemption, we put it specifically in our statute, the 67 Amendment. It said that no child can be admitted to public or private school unless age appropriately immunized, and it named the specific diseases and also designated that the health department could, Board of Health could create additional diseases to be immunized for. However, it went on to put in this exemption, unless the immunization conflicts with religious tenets and practices of a recognized church or religious denomination of which the parent or guardian is an adherent or member. And this was the particular phrase that was challenged in our case. And I would submit to you that, and I don't think there's only about four or five states that may have language that, such as recognized religion or some of the other language that requires the state to be more involved in determining what is acceptable to get a religious exemption. The more you have that type of language, the more likely your statute is going to be challenged based upon a First Amendment argument that the state is too entangled in either establishing or somehow inhibiting or interfering with religious right. This is a very important case in 72 out of New York because this is where we first see the philosophical exemption developing in the country in this New York case. New York Supreme Court determined that New York's religious exemption could not be limited to members of recognized religious groups. They went on in 87 to follow up on that decision in New York in the Scher case, where a parent challenged in New York's religious exemption, the judge relied on earlier state decisions, including the Mayer case that we looked at, to expand New York's religious exemption to include personal beliefs. So, in effect, from, what was that, 72 to 87, we see a growing personal philosophical exemption. Now, one thing to learn from New York in these cases is it doesn't necessarily require that you have that in your statute. You can see from this court determination that a philosophical exemption can be developed by case law, depending on how adamant or how much the judge may want to do that, and how, if possible, that particular case may be upheld in the higher court of your state. In our case, First, this Forbes guy challenged our statute in 87 after we added the religious exemption. And they, in an unpublished opinion, found that the federal ruled that our statute was constitutional. But, and we were going along just fine until 2002, when we had four separate challenged and combined cases. First was Cynthia Boone was challenged the hepatitis B vaccine. Ms. Boone's testified in court after I questioning her why she was opposed to the hepatitis B vaccine for her daughter, that it was the devil's plan, and that it was devil was in fact using this to get her daughter to be involved in promiscuous sex and drug use. And you know, I told her lawyer, I was a lawyer, I'd seen the devil's plan and that wasn't in there. But in any event, that was to no avail. And I was sitting there as she was testifying, and she was a nice lady, but she said that an angel had come and appeared on her dresser door and told her to be very careful. And I asked, you know, if the angel was there by right now, and Judge told me to stop asking those questions. And I was sitting there after all of this testimony saying, I can't believe I lost this case. But in any event, the second contestant was Daniel McCarthy, who challenged all of the vaccines. Shannon Law only challenged the varicella, and Susan Brock challenged hepatitis B. But, you know, it's easy, and it's kind of funny in a sense, in a sort of sad way, but, you know, these folks that are opposed to these vaccinations, it's very easy to fall into the determination or consideration that's just based upon some, you know, religious philosophy or whatever. But that's just not the case today. These have gone across many different spectrums of society and different cultures, different folks, very highly religious folks. I remember a kid that had polio, you know. I remember kids that were affected very harshly by diseases. A lot of people don't remember those things now. In any event, prior to the challenge, we required that the health department was basically looking at the tenets and practices, and we would get a statement from a preacher saying that it violated the tenets. We were determining how many people were in their church, how many members they had. One of the judges, in his opinion, stated that the health department was determining almost everything except where the person sat at the pew, and being critical of our determination in finding that it was unconstitutional. We had a specific sentence in there: personal or philosophical opposition without specific doctrinal conflict was not a valid basis for the exemption. So, very strong law in terms of what was required to be an organized, recognized religion. The court struck it down, and they ruled that religious exemption as applied was unconstitutional. But they found that compulsory immunizations were, of course, constitutional. So we became one of the three states then that had no religious exemption. So we're thinking, hey, this is good. We don't have a religious exemption. But to get just briefly, and I don't know how we're running on time, but to get just briefly into why the court struck our, and they struck it on three constitutional bases: one, that it violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, it violated the Free Exercise Clause, and it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. The basic analysis, though, comes down to the Establishment Clause. You can't have any rule, regulation, statute in any way inhibits or benefits a religion. They applied what's called the Lemon Test, which I can get in more detail later with if you want to talk about that aspect of the law. But they said that our having that being so intermingled into determining what the church doctrine was, the church membership, all of these things that we were requiring in order to get a religious exemption. Basically, we were acknowledging and deciding what was a recognized religion, which was a violation of the Establishment Clause. And when I looked a few years ago, there were at least four states that required organized, recognized, or established religion. So your state may be in that category, as we formerly did, and I would just advise that you may want to consider that issue further. 14 states require genuinely and sincerely held religious beliefs, which seems to be, if you read some law review articles at least, is a more acceptable language in a statute for achieving a religious exemption as opposed to going fully to a philosophical exemption. And then important language, I think, in the Boone case was that Arkansas's religious exemption discriminates against non-denominational, non-sectarian individuals with sincerely held religious beliefs and churches and denominations that do not have explicit teaching or immunizations, on immunizations, but leave such matters to individual religious conscience. So, let me move on just a little bit because I know we changed our law in Arkansas to allow for philosophical beliefs. And this is how we changed it. We changed our religious exemption to take out recognized religion. So now, as a result of legislative enactment in 2003, after our religious exemption was struck, and we became one of three states that had only a medical exemption, this is the change we got. If it conflicts with religious or philosophical beliefs of the parent or guardian. Now, we have taken steps to strengthen what that is in terms of requiring a notarized statement, some education, and so forth. I don't know that that necessarily changes the beliefs of people who philosophically are opposed to vaccinations, but in any event, the harder you make it, studies show that the more likely you have fewer exemptions. Now, this is Dr. Silverman had made this comment several years ago, and this has proven true in Arkansas. Of course, states offering both religious and philosophical exemptions, the philosophical will always exceed the combined medical and religious exemptions. And that's what you can see in 2002-2003, how basically the increase in philosophical exemptions after it went into effect. We now in 2008-09 have 1,891, or 74% of all of our exemptions now are philosophical exemptions. And also note, between the grades first through fifth, the high numbers of exemptors there in that category. So, has it had an effect? Obviously, we have more exemptors, more students that are taking the parents are taking the philosophical exemption. So, what? And this is a breakdown of the number of exemptions based upon a specific type of vaccine. And you can see the higher levels with respect to MMR and Hep B. Again, I think, you know, MMR, obviously, because of the Thimerosal allegations and studies regarding that, and then Hep B, because of the contention that it, as Ms. Boone had stated, made her daughter more promiscuous, which in my day that was the job of wine. So, so what were the results? Results were, as a result of our change in our philosophical exemption, it has led to, I believe, an unreliable number of medical contraindications. In other words, there's more people obviously not going to take their child to a doctor. They would take a philosophical exemption, so you don't get a true figure of what the medical exemptions are, which certainly could be important. It's allowed for more concentrated areas or pockets of unimmunized school-age children, and since we had no longitudinal tracking unavailable of children across years to determine the changes in exemption numbers and types, Then we don't know if you got the same individuals applying for different exemptions, different types of exemptions, or how many new and individual required exemptions there are. Finally, I just wanted to cover this with you because there is a argument out there, and it's most recently in the Michigan Law Review, where they talk about, is there civil liability on the part of a parent who refuses to get their child immunized? And I think this is going that way. We're going to see more and more people suing if their child either falls into a protected population because they lack the immunity, or if they're immunocompromised for whatever reason, or if the child is too young to have received all of their immunizations. So what are the four premises of civil liability? First, is there a duty on the part of parents to avoid causing harm to others? There's a reasonable argument that there is. Do they breach that duty by failing to vaccinate their children? Again, there's an argument there that they could, in fact. The third and most important issue is the one we saw developing in the autism cases, is the idea of causation. Then is there, would that child have gotten sick but for the fact that the other child had exposed them to the vaccine? Well, maybe not if that child had in fact been vaccinated as well. But as we know, not all vaccines work, and they certainly don't work perfectly. But so is that an intervening cause to the, and therefore break the chain? You have to have all four of these elements to have a negligence cause of action by one parent against the other. So thank you. In closing, I'll just say one thing I noticed, and I hope you all read the latest Newsweek version. There's a great article here tracking the autism and the anatomy of a scare. And I really like this quote from Dr. Offit, who says, and asked why people, even though the science had been basically disproven by many studies and valid studies, he states, perhaps he mused that because while it's very easy to scare people, it's very hard to unscare them. So thank you very much.
We have time for questions of our panel, and we wanted to allow you to be able to do that. Please come to the microphone to ask your questions. The sessions are recorded, and give your name and the organization that you represent. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Cheryl Ann Kraft. I'm from Naval Medical Center, Portsmouth. My question is for Mr. Hogan. In the issue of civil liability, one of the questions that it has been tossed about theoretically is, if a parent chooses not to vaccinate their child, and their child ends up becoming the index case for an outbreak, is there a requirement that we would release that information to the parents of the child that was infected because of the uninfected child, which would then give them the ability to file civil actions? Right now we can't because of HIPAA privacy laws, but if they're making a choice to put other people at harm, how would that then play out?
That's a good question. I think a couple of issues come to mind. One, and I think primarily you'd have to handle that through a subpoena, and you'd have to go to court to argue those issues out. But obviously confidentiality and privacy and HIPAA would raise the first flag to keep that type of information from being released. But you also have the registries that are out there, and I think that lends itself with respect to immunization data as opposed to other types of medical data, that type of information may in fact not have the same privacy constraints as other data that do have. And so you have to look at that argument as well because of the information currently existing in registries, which are great.
Hi, Kelly Moore with the Tennessee Immunization Program. Question for Mr. Hogan also. Tennessee has a very weak religious exemption. It's a, I guess you could call it a PRE, a personal religious exemption. Just has to disagree with their religious beliefs or practices, and they sign a statement, and that's all they need. We've been nervous about trying to push for anything stronger because we'd have to open up statute. We've sort of stayed left well enough alone. But are we in better shape than others with such a weak religious exemption with no personal philosophical exemption, or are we in more jeopardy that it would be very easy for someone to come in and convert that into a anything goes philosophical exemption? From a legal standpoint, are we good to sit where we are, or should we be nervous about trying to move one way or the other?
Well, I may have to look at your exemption to be certain, but I think the more and the tighter and stricter standards you had, the more likely you are to be challenged. But, you know, is it better to have a vague or ambiguous standard? It probably is from the standpoint of the federal constitutional challenge. It may not always be good from an administrative challenge that you'd receive if someone filed like a declaratory judgment action against you in state court or something like that, declaring what the statute meant. It's more likely the state judge might determine that that is vague, ambiguous, maybe even arbitrary, capricious. But I think on a federal standard, you might actually be better.
My name is Jian Qing from Maine, and I thanks to the three presenters, really good storyteller and with history, with data, with science. And I come here actually, it's more a question to the audience, because we are in Maine, face a very special situation. In Maine we have philosophical exemption, medical exemption, and the religious exemption. And our most challenging was we exclude these chickenpox, not vaccinated kids, and we try harder to exclude them. My question to you is, in your state, if you have this exemption, how hard, rigorously, you exclude these kids from school? With the law is the issue, and really how you push it, it's another level. So in your state, if you rigorously push this law, please raise hand. Okay, not many. Okay, thank you.
I'm Lydia McCoy with the Colorado Children's Immunization Coalition. And we really struggle with, on the one hand, the option of requiring parents to have less of an option to not vaccinate their children, so giving them fewer options to opt out, and also wanting them to want to vaccinate, and how those two go together. So we learned from your presentation that parents who are choosing the philosophical exemption are saying that their faith in the safety and efficacy of the vaccines is a factor. Have you seen any research that shows a correlation between states that have philosophical exemptions and whether those exemptions existence creates a state where parents are more encouraged to say, I should be questioning the vaccine because we have greater ability to?
Well, I think that's exactly what we're seeing, is that the ease of exemption really makes it easier to take them. Philosophical exemptions, it really opens up a whole new definition for exemption, just to say, well, I don't like them, I won't have my child vaccinated because I don't like the vaccines, and that really isn't based on anything. I think one of the questions is sort of how do you know, we're very dependent on the acceptability and acceptance of the school laws, because I think at its heart, if the parents really didn't support school immunization laws, and there are some studies, I think Dan Salmon did some of those, showing that there really is a pretty high acceptance rate of the school laws themselves, that if you start to lose the parents through too rigorous of enforcement, then the whole thing could crumble as well. And so the real question is, how do you reduce the number of exemptions, still allowing exemptions, but try to minimize it? And so what's the role of education? What's the role of exclusion from school? And I think that there's probably a lot more experimentation that needs to be done in this, because as the schedule gets more complicated, the different vaccines have different characteristics on how they work with against their diseases, that we're going to have to enter an era where probably more research needs to be done to figure out how to minimize those exemption rates in a way that's acceptable to parents. I know Nevada has an interesting program where I don't know if anybody from Nevada is here, but And you may want to say how it's working, but they require the parents to take a class in order to get an exemption. So, you know, sit there and be educated a little bit about the vaccines and the risks and all that. And if they say, well, I've taken the class and I still don't want to have the vaccine, well, that's fine. But I think just sort of the idea that you have to take a class, I think, has an impact in there. And I've heard of other states wanting to do that. So I think that we probably need to have a lot more research and evaluations on things that really are going on to try to reduce exemption rates. I mean, this is America. If somebody really doesn't want to vaccinate their child, they can't really be forced in too coercive a way, or the whole thing will crumble apart, I think.
Thanks.
My name's Audrey Munoz. I'm with the Immunization Division of the City of San Antonio. And my question is for Dr. Cuddy. On some of your data, I noticed that some of the reasons that parents weren't vaccinating, you had 13% recommendation from doctors or nurses. Were those for medical reasons, or were they from some other reason?
The study was done by Allison Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Is she here in the audience? Well, they didn't exactly specify what the reasons were as to why the physicians or the nurses recommended not getting their children vaccinated, but I can certainly touch base with Allison and see if she looked into it, and I can get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jan Bloom from the state of Wyoming. I'm the immunization section chief. Kind of relates to what Tennessee just shared, except for we're not going about it as tenderly as you are. We're kind of like, we're going to open school rules. We're just going to do it all. So we are getting ready to open our school rules. Part of the reason, the main reason, is Wyoming is probably the only state now that doesn't require varicella. However, we will be going for a two-dose series. So we're just going for gangbusters here. My question, first of all, to Arkansas is, we only have medical and religious exemptions currently. We know we are in for a fight. We've been preparing for it for months. We're not sure exactly when this whole thing is going to open, but it's going to be an interesting experience. My question is, in Arkansas, of course in Wyoming, we do have a notarized statement for religious exemption. However, we can't get any tenants, and that's fine. In Arkansas, is it a religious exemption permanent? Once you get it, it's done through K through 12?
I think you have to apply for it annually because, you know, you can backslide.
Okay. Well, and okay, that was part of my okay.
Some of us count on that.
Okay. Well, that's kind of where I was coming from. We're kind of in that position right now, and Lance sort of alluded to that also, is the more difficult you make it, the less exemptions you're going to see. And that's sort of where we're at right now, is, again, we're trying to make this as worthwhile as we possibly can. We know we're going to get lots of public comment, so we might as well just make it all out there. And so what we're trying to figure out is, based on what we're hoping to do, obviously, we continue to see the number of religious exemptions rise. And in our state, currently, it's once you get a religious exemption, you don't have to apply for it again. So we're about ready to change that. We're also getting ready to change to an annual application process. We're also getting ready to institute a policy where we will only give you the form. You have to write a letter to the Department of Health, recommend requesting the form so that then you can then get it notarized, submit it annually. So we're going to make it so that, again, if you really want to be exempt, here's the process. So it kind of goes back to what Lance mentioned. Again, if you truly ardently have these beliefs, these are the processes you will have to follow in order to get there. But again, I was just kind of curious about, I've heard about other states having annual requirements for religious exemptions. Our school nurses are really reluctant to go there. They really wanted to get rid of our 30-day exclusion law, where, you know, within 30 days, you're either up to date or you're out of school. But, you know, and again, they're pushing for everything. They want 30 days gone. They want, but the one thing they don't want is the annual application for religious exemptions because they're afraid of the paperwork. So,
One thing I just say, and I think that's the way to go about it, but one thing I just advise you too, and one thing I had wished I had raised and didn't, if they had a better lawyer, they would have had this right. But don't be afraid to raise sincerely held religious beliefs, because some of these people are actually not true believers about what they're going with. And I know in my case that she had misquoted Corinthians or something, you know, and she did not really know biblically what to, she was so, and I didn't press her on it. Number one, because you know it's been like 20 years since I opened the Bible, but no, I don't mean that. But I didn't. You should not be, and your attorney should not be in any way inhibited by pressing the argument of sincerely held religious beliefs when they are pressing the religious exemption as denial of the First Amendment rights.
And since Colorado spoke up, because we're your neighbor to the north, we get a lot of Coloradans coming up that have philosophical exemptions, and they come into our office and say, well, I'm here and I want a philosophical exemption. I just moved from Colorado, and I said, well, 10 miles ago you crossed the border. It's a new world. So, welcome to Wyoming.
Hey, while I've got the microphone, can I just acknowledge there's some public health servants that I have a great deal of respect for from the state of Arkansas that are here that I want to acknowledge. A few, Linda Gladden and Kathy Bodenheimer and Billy Knott are public health nurses in our state, and they are very dedicated to what they do. And also Karen Fowler, who's the head of our particular division. And I just want to just acknowledge them being here and for all the work they do for us.
Hi, Kelly Moore with Tennessee again, and just as a quick follow-up, it's totally unrelated. Actually, one of the issues is that our religious exemption is in Tennessee code, not in rules, so it's not something that we have access to through rulemaking. We have to go to the legislature, and we do not want our legislature opening up the Tennessee code to change things because we don't know what would happen. So it all depends on where your exemptions exist, whether it's in code or in regulation. That makes a big difference. But one thing I wanted to ask about on Lance's discussion about the enforcement of school requirements is that a lot of that, the difficulty with enforcement of school requirements depends on who the state authorizes to enforce the requirement.
That's right.
And in Georgia, my understanding is that Georgia public health folks can enforce the review of the immunization certificates. You can correct me on that, on the details, but in Tennessee, unfortunately, again, in Tennessee code, it says the Department of Education is specifically responsible for enforcing the requirements. All health can do is stipulate the diseases and create the form, but we have no enforcement authority whatsoever, and that's established in code, and that's been tremendously bad for us in terms of getting enforcement, because our Department of Education colleagues, God bless them, think of it as a paperwork issue.
Yeah, I think that's just a great point. I remember when we were doing some of the studies for the Calling the Shots report, you know, in terms of in-kind contributions. The in-kind contribution from the school system was enormous because of all this work. And so I think that you're kind of talking about the other side of it, is that you really don't have the authority to do that work, then it may not get done the same way, and then priorities of the educational system are going to change. It's a really good point.
Hi, Shirley and Kraft. I have a follow-up question, kind of maybe wider scope than y'all want, but we actually used our Virginia statute for implementation of our healthcare facility influenza compliance kind of rule for medical and religious, and we were really tight on the rules. And out of an institution of about 6,000 people, we had 4 people that qualified for religious exemptions. We were quite happy. We had 21 that qualified for medical. And then we found ourselves in a situation where, since someone who did not qualify under the standard religious exemption, because ours is similar to yours, had to be with the tenets of the faith, she pulled the EEO card, which under EEO pretty much, if the sky is purple, that could be your religious exemption. It's exceptionally broad. Opening it up to making essentially any religious exemption than philosophical, do you see that being a tremendously dangerous slippery slope in healthcare worker or workplace required vaccinations in the future?
Well, I just see that I think you have a younger, newer population of people who are highly educated a lot of times that are taking a very philosophical approach about exemptions, not necessarily related to religion or otherwise. And I think there will be a trend legally to use this Scheer case that I pointed to in New York and the Mayer case as a legal president to pursue what's currently on the books as a religious exemption and argue to the court to expand that basically to a non-denominational philosophical exemption.
We'll take one last question.
And then I have a few housekeeping announcements.
This is actually not a question. My name is Sue Leinbacher from the Chester County Immunization Coalition in Pennsylvania. We had two elementary schools that underwent chickenpox outbreaks. And I just wanted to let people know that in each of those schools, there were five parents who had philosophical differences to vaccination. And when faced with the fact that their children would be out of school for several weeks, suddenly the next day they did not have those exemptions and the children were immunized. So, you know, sometimes pragmatics, you know, our families are working and they're not in a position to stay home for, 4 or 6 weeks.
Yeah. I think implementation matters, and using those opportunities makes a big difference, yeah.